Our reading today is a very interesting one for the end of the year. Every once in a while we have 53 Sundays, but we don't this year, so this is the last one, number 52. There's this obscure reading number 53 that whoever can do the math, every once in a while we see it, but almost never. We end with this one, which is a humdinger. You know, it's just there it is, and this is what you get, and this is what you got to do. I mean, it's the essence of what makes Christianity hard for a lot of people in the world to accept, is because the way the churches interpret this statement, you're just right there and you can't do anything about it. Last week, I believe it was, or the week before, when I was talking about Jesus in India and Thomas going to India, maybe that was perhaps last week, when Christmas happens, everything, time gets very strange. But later on, Nirmoha, who has a great background in Christian theology, was telling me that there was this whole cycle of, I know some of you, this is the middle of the sentence, so I'll just give you enough so you know what I'm talking about. I was talking about the disciple of Jesus who was Thomas, who received, this is historical documentation. There's a website that I trust that was written by someone I know with a lot of this research. Thomas received a direct guidance from Jesus that his assignment was to go to India. And so there is a strong Christian element in South India that was all based on the Apostle Thomas arriving there. His work was completely separate from all the other disciples. The other disciples, after the crucifixion, after Jesus died, got together to decide what to do. But Thomas was never part of that because he had his assignment directly. Everybody was waiting for me last week to say the obvious, which, isn't there an interesting parallel with Swami Kriyananda's life? Yes, isn't there? And we all often wondered where Swami was in the life of Jesus. We all wanted him, his life fits the story of St. Paul to a certain extent. But whenever we would propose to Swami that he might have been St. Paul, he had two interesting answers. One, I would like to think that Paul would be liberated by now and wouldn't be reincarnating. And two, he said, I never really liked Paul very much. In other words, his personality was not compatible with Swami's. We know almost nothing about Thomas for the reason that I was saying last week, is that all evidence of his mission in India, not evidence because his body's there and the history is there, but his actual message was converted into the Catholic Church centuries later. But Nirmoha told me that the Christian line on that, the church line, is that when the missionaries finally got to South India and found this thriving devotion to Jesus that looked a great deal like Sanatan Dharma. Didn't look like Hinduism, but it looked like the truth behind Hinduism, which is great. Avatars come, we are devoted to them. They teach the same teaching in new ways, and we are re-inspired in our quest for self-realization. That what was called Christianity looks so much like the indigenous understanding of spirituality that the missionaries decided that what Thomas had brought had been corrupted by the people there over time. So they fixed it. Don't you just love the human mind? I mean, it's just like, just exactly what Helen was saying. In a universe with no visible center, it can be understood from any point. And we make the decision we make is that the point of reference, the obvious point of reference actually, is me. What else would it be except me? The thing is, though, that's not a conscious decision. That's actually the essence of an unconscious decision, because we're looking out from our eyes, and the point of view that we see is the point of view related to our identity and our dedication to this physical body. We just think that's the way it is. It's so interesting to me the way Master teaches. The spiritual eye is here and the medulla is here. And Master adds into the understanding of the chakras that this is the medulla is the opposite pole of the spiritual eye. And he explains how that this is the source of ego. This is where the sperm and ovum come together, and that's the first point when the jiva, the individualized spirit, enters into the physical world. It's right here at the medulla. And apparently, medically speaking, there's no way they can operate on this point, because this is really the seat of life. And most of us live essentially with our sense of self here, because we're ego-identified. The infinite spark within us has identified with the present limitation. And that's really why we look out through our eyes. We don't look out through our eyes because of all the brain wiring. It's because we're sitting here and we're looking out. And we look through the two eyes. But then when our identification moves from limitation to spirit, then we look through the spiritual eye. If thine eye be single, thy whole body will be full of light, which means that thy body will be light. And when we look with the two eyes, we see this dual reality. But we all move through this universe from our particular little perspective. I mean, we just can't help it. We're all sitting here. We really don't know what's going on at Starbucks. We might want to know. We might prefer to know, but we don't know because we're trapped here. And we just can't see. An infinite master, if he cared to know, could know. You know, when Swami Kriyananda said something that Master thought was a little inappropriate in the way he was trying to share the teachings, when he was trying to convince an atheistic man of the presence of God by talking about miracles, Master later said to him, "That's not really such a smart thing to say at such a time." He said it, he didn't say that, but he said, "Better not talk about miracles to someone like that." And Swami, he didn't mind being corrected. He loved being corrected. But it was more like, Master was nowhere around and no one was around. How did he know? Master just said casually, "I know every single thought that you think." I mean, Master was not centered in the medulla. Master was centered in the spiritual eye, and everything that happened anywhere in creation was happening to him from his perception, if he wanted to perceive it. It literally boggles the mind. Swami Kriyananda talks about sitting at the feet of Master, just trying to expand his awareness into Master's consciousness. Just how can he be infinite and yet sitting in front of me talking about this? And Master, well, there were two responses. There were twice that Swami tells the story of just trying to get his mind around what Master was. And in one case, he said Master just sort of, with great sympathy, handed him an apple. Just sort of like, "Poor boy, you'll never get this." And on another occasion, Master just looked at Swami so seriously and said, "If you knew my consciousness," meaning don't even try. You know, you simply can't understand what you can't understand. It's so interesting on the spiritual path how many times we come around again and again and again to the same ideas. And I will say it, and other people will say it to me, you just get it finally. I do remember when a woman who'd been in seclusion for a couple of weeks came out, and she was so excited. This was after we'd been on the path 25 years. She came to me and she said, "God is love." And I didn't understand at first what she was saying, and I said, "Pretty basic." And she said, no, God is love." And then I listened more carefully to what she was saying. And that's why on our particular path, we never define greater and greater realization by a greater and greater capacity to intellectualize. Because more and more ability to say things and study things and know facts may or may not have anything to do with our state of realization. Because if we know even one divine truth, and it's we're putting words to an actual experience, I mean, if you know that God really is love, think about how everything in your life is going to be different. I mean, you could write that out in a school book 1,000 times, 100,000 times, and you would have memorized the words, but would it actually change the way you live? It only changes the way you live when you actually suddenly know that. God is love and I am one with God. What are the implications of that? Now, this particular reading, which is the culmination of our year and the end of our Christmas season. Christmas season has been this time of, hopefully, of a great transformation of consciousness in which we've seen and experienced many things that were words to us before that have now become deeper realities. So then we get this really simple statement, I am the way, the truth, and the light. Now, the entire understanding of the Bible entirely is the pronoun I. And Swami touches on it very lightly. All misunderstanding or understanding of the is about the pronoun I. If I means Jesus, the physical body, the daughter, the son of Mary, and the son of Joseph by human or divine means, as Master puts it, but one way or another, that body that actually had a birth and a death, if that's what Jesus meant when he said I, then all of our point of focus has to go back in time and has to be defined by that picture. But where was Jesus living? When Jesus said I, what did he actually mean? Swami tells us the story of Yogananda. He puts it this way. Yogananda himself said, when it's time for me to reincarnate again, and you often wonder, like, what kind of a system is there? Is there a board meeting? Do they all get together? Does it randomly occur to him? I mean, just like, where does this come from? Well, we actually know. Jesus appeared to Babaji. Now, if Master himself was Jesus, if Jesus appeared to Babaji, they decided it was time to send another messenger. Yogananda becomes that messenger. The anthropomorphizing, you might say, of that level of reality is really not so far off the mark, in the sense that everything we do in this world is a dumbed down expression of what happens on a higher level. So the way we interact and the way we understand is, it's not, the reason we behave the way we do is because we have a tiny thread of that infinity and we bring it down. But in one way or another, Yogananda realizes he's going to have to be Yogananda, or the infinite spark of spirit that has no name realizes it's going to have to incarnate in an Indian body that goes to the West and brings all his disciples to help them again, help them through it one more time. And Los Angeles is going to be a good place for some of them, and Palo Alto a good place for others, and who knows where. But he said, when I see the personality I have to assume, he says, it's confining at first, like a heavy overcoat on a hot day. I mean, isn't that just an amazing image? Because you would think, just, you know, like, why would you put it on? It itches, it's uncomfortable, it inhibits your actions. But then he says, after a while, I get used to it. Isn't it just a wild combination of things? I know some of us, even in the personalities that we presently assume, they still feel a lot like a overcoat on a hot day, don't they? I remember a friend of mine, a female person, was totally convinced as a female child that all female children eventually grew up to be men. And, you know, I now know there's a whole psychological syndrome for that. It wasn't like she had a syndrome. It was just that she was so incredulous to find herself female that she figured there had to be some way this was going to resolve itself. She was more than a little disappointed to find out that that wasn't what was going to happen. And, you know, adjusted admirably to it. But nonetheless, it's just, here we are. We're in these heavy overcoats on very hot days. But we get used to it. Of course, Yogananda, when Swami asked him, when you play a role like William the Conqueror or something like that, something so far outside, he said, you know, do you always remember? And Master said, in your heart, you're always free. But who knows his consciousness? How do you understand that? So when such a person, such a jiva, such an individualized spark of spirit, assumes a personality, when they say I, what could they possibly be referring to? In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you know, both of us have lived many, many, many times before, but Krishna says to Arjuna, I remember all my births. You do not. So if you remember all your births and you use the pronoun I, who are you talking about? That was that wonderful moment that I was told that Bella Bingham had just before she died. which is in the last days of her life. She was in her 40s, I think, a woman at Ananda, many of you know her. And she said, she was just lying there. She knew she, at a certain point in the progress of the cancer that she had, you know, she just had a discussion with the doctors and they just decided how much care she would be given and how long she had to live. So she was perfectly conscious of where she was at in the process and utterly courageous in it. And just lying there, waiting. And at one point, a friend of mine was with her and Bella said, I see thousands of faces in front of me, going by in front of me, and I know that every one of them has been my face. And she says, it's very hard to be very concerned about the face I'm wearing now when you see how many of them you've worn before. Now, in such a consciousness, when you say I, what could you possibly mean? Even when we think in the context of our one life, you know, I, the little child, I, the adult, I, the, you know, excited youth, I, the brokenhearted old man, old woman. When you say I, who are we really talking about? And we don't even know how we got here and why we feel. You know, the pronoun could have so many implications. And of course, for Jesus, I and my Father are one, he said. So when he used the pronoun I, he was talking, obviously, he was talking about the infinite spirit. So when he says, I am the way, what could that mean? It can't possibly mean that all people are damned to hell unless they accept Jesus Christ as their Savior. I recognize that for some people, that's the only way they can have faith. I met a man once who, before he was saved by Jesus Christ, was a drug addict on the streets. And nothing less than that absolute, rigid, no margin, completely defined faith was going to keep him out of addiction and off the streets. I saw a woman in a coffee shop once. She had a sort of a tank top on and across her back in a tattoo with letters about this big. It said, redeemed, like that. And on one level, it was in questionable taste. But on the other level, I just wanted to stand up and cheer. Go, girl, you wear that well. You know, that's just like, I understand how you feel. You can really imagine what it would be like to be redeemed when you felt you were lost. But we have to keep on. Because at a certain point, we can't be that small. It just doesn't wear, we don't wear it well anymore. It doesn't make sense to us. But still, he said it. I am the way. I am the truth and the light. Even more, the gate is closed to you unless you come this way. I saw a cartoon of St. Peter at the pearly gates, and there's a cat coming up, you know, to get into heaven. But instead, the cat hands St. Peter a punch card with 9 slots on it. And about 5 of them are punched. He punches number 6, you know, and gives it back to you. But the gates are closed to us. Now, in an external perspective, in a dogmatic perspective, St. Peter is there, and he does close the doors against us. Master used to love to tell this joke about a very famous evangelist in Los Angeles whose name was Billy Sunday. He was from Master's time. We don't even know about him now. Flash in the pan of fame. And it was said that when Billy Sunday got to heaven, St. Peter was looking through the book, and he said, I'm sorry, I just don't see your name here in the book. And Billy Sunday said, but I sent so many people to heaven, because he'd been an evangelist and they'd all been saved. And Peter said, well, you may have sent them, but none of them arrived. Meaning that you can't fool it. You can't just say, I'm there. The I that Jesus is talking about is the I of the true power of spirit. And by the true power of spirit, I mean the infinite power of spirit that transcends all of this. I do think that people have very deep faith in a more narrow concept, and actually this is exactly what the Gita says, so let me just go there for a moment. The Gita says, in whatever way people worship me, in that way I come to them. So we all stand where we stand. I feel like that drug addict man, that ex-drug addict man I met who was so deeply devoted to Jesus, he was making much more progress than any intellectual atheist because he was trying. He was worshiping. He was looking forward. He was looking up. Backwards for me, forwards for him. So what we're really looking for, and this brings us back to I am the way, what the I is that movement of toward self-expansion. Expanding our limited identity, our confinement, our sense of impotence, our sorrow, our selfishness, and the only way to freedom, well, the only way to happiness is through the infinite I, which is wherever we are, we need to expand it just a little farther. In the universe with no visible center, it can be picked up from any perspective. And so the perspective that we're all living in is the perspective of how do I feel and how can I feel better? How am I suffering and how can I ease that suffering? And this is where there is only one way. And that way is to relinquish. Relinquish our sort of spoiled brat, I want it my way. There was a little girl who came to our kindergarten once, and she, her parents were sort of essentially trying to outlast her childhood. Sometimes parents do that. They don't really know how to cope with a small child, and they just hope if they just wait long enough, they won't have a small child anymore. So it was sort of one of those families where the child was just pretty much on her own, and parents just didn't know how to deal with her. My friend Prahlad says he remembers being a newborn infant and having his mother hold him for a while, then his father hold him for a while, then his mother hold him for a while. And in his newborn brain, he remembers thinking, they don't have any idea what to do with me. And he became quite nervous at that point. But a lot of parents don't. So this little child came to our school, and she was a sort of, you know, some children are built like tanks. She was sort of built like a tank, just a big, solid child. And she was in kindergarten, and when things didn't go her way, she would just begin to scream, just scream. And she had a hefty set of lungs. She would just scream. And finally, the kindergarten teacher was very, very good, just took her aside, put her in a separate place, and she said, "At home, when you do this, does this get you what you want?" "Usually," she said. "Well, I want you to know it doesn't work here." And then she just put her in the room and said, "Go ahead and scream, but I'm just not going to pay any attention." And in a short period of time, she stopped screaming because it didn't work. Right? Well, that's really how we live our lives. We do, don't we? You know, we just think somebody should pay attention to me. And I'm making a joke of it, but it is no joke. I remember, to my utter embarrassment, one seclusion I was in when I started running some tape about how the whole world ought to work from my perspective. Why weren't they listening to me? And I was trying to just find, you know, what the fulcrum point of my annoyance was. That it actually came down to somebody owes me an apology. Like this, you know, somebody should apologize to me for not treating me the way I know I should be treated. Of course, then I began to laugh. Who owes me an apology? But that is how we live in this world, don't we? I mean, really think about it. We're just walking around, and we want them to be different. And the difference we want is we want them to do it my way. And sometimes we literally scream, or weep, or cry, or get mad at God, or go crazy. Sometimes we go crazy, literally. We have to be incarcerated for a time because we just check out. I mean, that's that kind of metaphysical madness is something that I guess I'm not that far away from it. I kind of get that one. I mean, I talked to Swamiji once about it. I said, you know, it seems to me because I had a couple of people in my life that, and I really felt that's what they did, just for a time. He said, yeah. He said, you get right up on the brink of it. And you realize I am the way, the truth, and the light. And no one comes unto the Father except through me. And you think, I'm having none of this. You mean I really have to overcome my selfish desires? I really have to expand beyond my little identification with my ego and my little perspective, and nobody's ever going to apologize to me? And we just say, I think I'm just out of here for a time. And so Swami says, you just go into a dream world. You know, just go into a world of your own making. Because that's what madness is. It's just an absolute refusal to relate to an objective universe. It's just an entirely subjective universe. It's a unique kind of hell and nothing to be made light of. But it's just a metaphysical truth. Swami says every devotee goes through incarnations like that. Where we're going to have the ultimate hissy fit and see if anything changes. Okay? I'm going to take all my toys and not play your game at all. You know, just I'm just going to go here and just talk to these beings, you know, and live in this world or this paranoia and just see if that works. It doesn't. Because no one comes into the Father except through me. But you see, that me is our own self. That I is our own infinite self. The only way to go through is to enter into the spine, to progress through the chakras, to move our identification from the ego to the spiritual eye. Then the infinite opens up to us. And how long it takes to do this? How much misery there is along the way? Well, it's really in our hands. We make decisions that seem like a good idea at the time, and we veer off the path, and then we get pushed back onto it. Then we go forward for a little while until it's just too much, and then we veer off the path for a while, and then we get pushed back onto it. And veering off the path is not getting married or having children or going out and having a job or having a business. It's that much deeper, much more subtle thought. Oh, look, I get to have it my way. This time I get to have it my way. Instead of, no, this one is for you, Lord. One of the great souls at Ananda Village was reputed to have said early on in his spiritual life, he just said, I don't know, Master, if I'm going to be able to, you know, how strong I'm going to be forever, but this life is for you. That's just a wonderful way to think of it, isn't it? I don't know how long I can keep this promise, but this life is for you. Let's make it even smaller. Today is for you. For the next hour, it's for you. Just what eye do we want to be? Which eye is the one that we want to hold in our hearts and live by? Which doorway do we want to walk through? Who do we want to become? How long do we want to wait? Really, it's all in our hands. We can be, as that girl proclaimed, redeemed. Lord, I offer into thy infinite light the little self that is me. Make me one with your spirit. Make me free. God bless you.